Tonight is the true test of courage. Considering the weather reports and the gray skies, delighted to see you all. Today, I'm taking my life in my hands because to talk of Western civilization or its Greek component, from Plato to Freud, is like talking about the entire Cleveland Public Library, or the entire burden of courses in the liberal arts college of Case Western Reserve or John Carroll. What I'd like to try and do is to step back a little bit from our own education and look at Western society a little bit as we looked at Chinese society and Indian society. Try and draw out the major themes. I'd like to begin by talking a little bit about that famous red figure vase pot that has been placed on exhibition by the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I spoke about it several Sundays ago in comparing 6th century BC Hebrew creativity with Greek creativity at the same period. I'd like to use it in another context tonight. I don't know how many of you have seen pictures or heard about this famous million-dollar vase, but it's a rather large, it's called a calyx crater. That's a large pottery bowl, black with red painting on it, which was used by the nobility of ancient Greece at their banquets to mix water and wine to the required consistency. I don't know if you had more water or more wine, but anyway, that was the purpose for which it was used. And I finally got to see this pot about 2 weeks ago. The only other time I tried to see it, the room, as I told you, had been preempted by the television cameras and Hoving, who's the director of the museum, because that was the day on which they announced that this pot had probably been smuggled out of Italy and was the hot pot that I keep referring to. In any case, about 10 days ago, I was in New York, and again, I was determined to see this vase, and I went over and had a good chance to take a look at it, and I was struck by something that I had not seen talked about in literature. There are two scenes painted on this vase. The front is a scene of the arming of a group of young men who are about to go out and do battle. The central figure is a man who's identified in letters on the picture as Sarpedon, a figure who is known to us from the Iliad, who was the king of a community called Lycia, an ally of Troy, who went to Troy's defense very early in this long 10-year war with Greece, remained one of the staunchest allies of Greece, was the boldest of the fighters and the bravest, and towards the end of the war kept wondering why he was doing all the fightings while the Trojans were doing all of the eating and drinking back behind the walls. And the reverse picture of this vase shows the figure of Sarpedon, a corpse. It's a naked figure of a dead warrior. Blood is spurting out of various wounds, and he's being lifted off the field of battle by two winged figures that are announced as Thanatos and Hypnos, the winged figures of sleep and of death. And in the background, you see the figure of Apollo sort of supervising the removal of this dead hero to his proper burial. Now, what struck me, and I must confess it struck me as a rabbi, were the two shields which are evident in the arming scene, the two giant Greek shields, and each bears the symbol of the totem of the clan or the city of the hero who carried the shield. And one of the shields bears as the totem a great big crab, and the other bears as the totem a great big crayfish or lobster. And I immediately thought of our own Bible. We have in the Bible, as you know, a series of dietary laws. And one of these laws says that the we as Jews may eat. Anything that swims in the sea, provided it has fish, it has fins and scales. We're not to eat anything that doesn't have fins and scales, which means essentially shellfish. And when most of us were growing up, some nice Sunday school teachers or well-intentioned rabbis explained this to us, or our parents did, as a kind of primitive hygienic rule. Shellfish spoiled easily, the pig, the wild boar, carried all kinds of worms along with it which got into the intestines, and our ancestors were simply bound by these taboos to a series of very important early hygienic rules. Unfortunately, if you read the Bible carefully, chapter 11 of the book of Leviticus, if you want to look at it, you'll find out that the Bible makes no attempt to explain these laws as hygienic rules, but says simply, after listing all the kashrut rules, "Vitkadishtem vitem kadoshim ki kadosh ani," and you shall become holy through these rules, through these observations, because I, your God, am holy, and that is the what you are to be in a state of holiness. And when the word kadosh is used in our Bible, it defines the rules which separate Jews from non-Jews. And what really these dietary laws seem to be in origin all about is an attempt to deny to the Jew certain kinds of foods which were the totems of ancient gods. You know, in Christianity today, when communion is taken, by transubstantiation, by the miracle of the Mass, the wafer is turned into the body and the wine is turned into the blood of the Christ. And somehow by ingesting these elements which are transformed into something divine, the God, you commune with the God enters you and becomes part of you, and in a sense you are saved by this act of communion. It's called table fellowship. Now, in the ancient world, the boar, the pig, was the totem of Moab. And the crayfish, the shellfish, were the totem of the sea peoples, particularly the Phoenicians. And Lycia was a great community which had been established by the so-called sea peoples, the Phoenicians. So here we have sort of a classic visual explanation of what the old laws of kashrut were really all about. An attempt to separate the Jew from an act which might have seemed idolatrous, and it's an act in which he would participate in a pagan religious ceremony. Now, all this obviously is totally irrelevant to what I want to talk to you about tonight. But it leads me into the ability to use, first of all, I'll tell you a little bit about kashrut, and secondly, to lead you into a discussion of the theme through this vase. Because this vase has other interesting features which are relevant to tonight. The first is the writing on the vase. The vase identifies each of the characters. Sarpedon, Hypnos, Thanatos, Apollo, and so on. But more importantly, on the top of one of the pictures, along the side of the other, there is the phrase Leandros Kalos, which is a dedication phrase which means to my good-looking young lover, Leander, which is a very good reminder to us all that as much as the Bible prohibited any form of homosexuality, it was an accepted practice in the Greek world, that in Greek ethics there were all kinds of values, the naked display of the athlete, the exposure of children as a form of primitive birth control, homosexuality, etc., which were totally foreign, alien, and inimical to the Jewish attitudes towards life. What I'm trying to say here is that Western civilization rests upon two not necessarily similar ethical, theological, and philosophic cultural traditions. One is Hebrew and one is Hellene, one is Greek and one is Jewish. Having said that, let's take another look at the vase. The two images on the vase both come from the great epic which we all had to read when we were way back there in high school called the Iliad. the great story of the 10-year war by probably in the 12th or 13th century before the Common Era, the war of the Argives, the Greeks, against the Trojans. The war probably was all about control of the Dardanelles. He who controlled the Dardanelles controlled passage into the Black Sea, to the great mining areas of Russia, to the great forests of Russia, to the great wheat fields of Russia. The Trojans controlled this trade route. They were able to impose tolls and taxes, and the expansion-minded Greeks weren't about to put up with it for very long. But the interesting thing about this epic, and the important thing for our purpose, is that Greek literature and Greek culture is based on a series of epics, great traditional poems and legends, each of which described man or men facing a series of terrible trials or obstacles and struggling as best they can to overcome. And the nobility of a man is in the struggle, not necessarily in the success or victory in the struggle. There's the story of the 10-year war of Achilles and Ajax and Agamemnon against Hector and Priam and Troy. There's the story of the 10-year voyage of Odysseus as he tries to get home against a wind which won't allow him to land in Ithaca. And he's faced with a whole series of obstacles which preclude his getting home to his beloved Penelope. There's the great epic which deals with Jason and the Argonauts. Jason and the great band of heroes who go off to find the Golden Fleece. There's the great epic which tells us of the many Herculean efforts of Heracles himself. Now, if you remember when we spoke about Buddhist attitudes, the Buddhist attitude began in the principle life is suffering, and having accepted that truth, one's response is expected to be, let's withdraw from this world of suffering, let's deny the world, let's escape from it into some kind of peace, which is not of this world. The Greek world accepted the bruisings and the beatings and the trials and the tribulations of life. It made no attempt to gloss these over, but it measured man not in terms of escape from the world, but in terms of his gaining glory by undertaking the struggle. In the Greek world, the measure of a man begins with the statement, life is suffering, and requires the second statement, nevertheless, I will face up to life in as manly, forgive the term, ladies, but woman's lib was unknown in those days, in as manly a way as I can. I will not flinch. I will not cave in. I will do what has to be done without any real hope that I will ultimately win through. The Greeks believed in what they called moira, pursuing kind of fate. Greek theater, as you know, tends to the tragic. Man is pursued by a fate which he cannot really escape. But he is also a man. He has will. He can have courage. He can have wisdom. And the test of a man is his willingness to stand up to the buffeting of an outrageous fortune. So there is a glorification of man unknown in Indian thought, and a willingness to accept life for what it is without romance, which is totally foreign to our modern temper, when we tend always to think of progress and the world getting better and better, and when we tend to be unhappy with the idea that all may not work out, you know, well in the end. Let me remind you of what these epics are like. Remind you of the story that I'm sure you all know, the story of Odysseus, the story of the Odyssey. As you recall, the story begins in the 9th year of Odysseus's attempt to get home. And he has been for the last 8 years in a paradise-like prison. He has fallen in the hands of a nymph by the name of Calypso, and she has fallen in love with his body. She won't let him go. Though after 8 years, I guess she finally tires of him and she puts him adrift in the sea on a raft. And Odysseus is carried along by the tides of the Mediterranean. He finds himself finally in a kingdom called Phaeacia. And again, a beautiful young girl falls in love with him. And the king, he tries to tell the king, he has to get home to Penelope, his wife. And the king says, well, tell me what happened to you up till this point, and I may see that you get home. And back home in Ithaca, as you know, Penelope is pushing off all the suitors who want her beauty and her land. More important, I suspect, the land than the beauty. And she's put them off by saying, when I finish this particular piece of knitting, I'll make my decision among you. And every night she unravels as much as she knit during the day. And her son Telemachus has escaped from the palace to try and find his father. And his father has tried to get home, not too hard sometimes, but he's tried to get home. But every time they get close to Ithaca, the wind blows up from the shore and the ship can't put in. That's what fate is really all about. And then he tells the king of Phaeacia how when they set out, he and his men and many ships from Troy to come home, they sailed very easily almost to sight of Ithaca, and the wind pushed them away, and they came to the land of the lotus eaters, the land of forgetfulness, and they were given the waters of forgetfulness, and only he somehow managed not to drink, and he had to bind the men and carry them back on board because they were happy to remain here in this kind of drunken stupor. And he tells them then how he went to the land of the Cyclops and how there they were imprisoned in the cave of Polyphemus, the terrible ogre Cyclops who would not let them go, who was a cannibal who ate many of them. And only by getting him into a drunken stupor and taking the mast of one of their ships and ramming it through his eye, making him blind, were they able to escape by hanging on to the bottom of the rams as they went out in the morning to graze in the field so that the blind Cyclops couldn't feel them. And then there are a series of adventures which take them through the siren call where they have to stuff wax in their ears. In the land of the Lacedaemonians where the cannibals attack them, and Circe, the treacherous beauty, who will only let them go when Odysseus is willing to make love to them. And finally, one by one, all the companions have dropped by the side. Only Odysseus remains, and he is shipwrecked between Scylla and Charybdis, and he has been cast up then into Calypso's loving, imprisoning arms. Well, the king of Phaeacia, you may recall, blindfolds Odysseus and carries him home in one of his ships, and he wreaks terrible vengeance upon the suitors, and that's the end of the story. But the theme of the story, as it was interpreted by the Greeks, is not in the happy conclusion. The importance of the story is that these set of trials mythologize the realities of life. In life, there are cannibals who are ready to eat you up. In life, there are all kinds of women who are ready to trap you if you're not careful. There are all kinds of, there's wine and there is drink and there are drugs, all kinds of things which will put you in a stupor, make you forget what life is really all about if you're not careful. And these are the stories on which Greeks, young Greeks, were educated. Poetry was the basis of the Greek educational system during the Classic Age. And this concept of life as being a long, difficult, arduous voyage is the image which the Greek had of what lay before him. How does one meet, then, the challenges of life? First, one must recognize it's the danger, accept reality, do what he can, have the physical courage of what he is capable of, and then one must exhibit courage and wisdom and such foresight and planning as one can imagine. Now, unlike modern man who tends to image himself as a god, there's nothing we can't do if we don't put our minds to it. There's no problem, be it race or the energy crisis or the urban crisis or poverty, which we can't solve, we think, if we put our minds to it. The ancients, the Greeks in this case, were quite convinced that not all problems were soluble, that most men would not win their way home. They would be eaten by the cannibals or destroyed by wine or drink or women or something else. And that it was the rare man, in fact, who managed to win through to the end. Man must learn to accept his place in life. The world was as it will be. The concept of progressive change, of an unfolding, developing, improving world is a concept of which the Greeks were innocent. The world was as it is as it will be. If anything, it'll get a little bit worse. It will not necessarily improve. And so the great philosophy of the Greek world is essentially the philosophy of the Stoics. A man named Zeno in the 4th century before the Common Era was the great teacher of, who formulated the ideas of the Stoics, but they are essentially common to most Greek philosophic traditions. And Stoic philosophy, as we used to use the word Stoic to describe a man who does not show emotion in the face of anxiety or tension or pain, he would say he accepts the pain stoically. But essentially Stoic philosophy, as the Greeks understood it, began with our ability, man's ability, to separate out two ideas. Those things which I can change, and those things which I cannot change. Those things which simply are, which I must adjust to, accept, and those things which I can control and master and make my own. Now, what are the things I cannot change? I cannot change my time of birth, my rank of birth, whether I'm a Greek or a barbarian. I cannot change my sex. I cannot change the bundle of talents with which the gods placed in me. I cannot really change the world into which I was born. I cannot change the uncertainties of life, the fact that I'll grow up and there'll be war and I may have to die in the war. Or that I'll be traveling between Athens and Ithaca and suddenly pirates may come and I may be, become a slave in a galley for the rest of my life. I must learn to accept the inconsistencies, the buffeting, the changeability, the uncertainties of life. These I cannot master. Success does not lie in owning a great deal because you're going to lose what you own. It does not lie in having great rank because that's a matter of chance. And if your city happens to lose the battle, suddenly the king becomes a slave or he's beheaded. Those things I cannot master. What I can master is the inner man, the things I feel, my own awareness and perception of myself. And so the Stoics like to say, I can be a free man even if I'm a slave in the salt mines under the broiling heat of the Sahara Desert. Nothing can reach me if I truly feel that I am myself. If I don't care very much about things, rank, place, beauty, health, opportunity, if I'm willing to accept life for what it is and hold on to my inner spirit as inviolate as myself, then nothing can reach me. And the great virtues are ataraxia, by which they meant endurance, not caring very much about appearance, physical things, not getting a great ego kick out of making a great deal of money or having, you know, a great dinner offered in our honor or receiving the olive branch, olive wreath as the winner in the Athenian, in the Olympian Games. Accept life as it is, learn to control your inner life, not to care too much about what happens in the world of tears, the uncertain world, the difficult world, the brutal world. Worry about what happens inside of you. Build up your mind. Build up your spirit. These things can never be taken from you. Or so they thought. And that's the drive of Stoic thought and the basic element in Greek philosophy. It's a very private kind of thing. It's not very optimistic. Unlike Jewish thought, there is no great messianic hope. The world is not improving every day. There is no great kingdom of God here on earth. What there is challenge. And what man must do is learn to live in such a way as to be equal to the challenge. This world is, what do the Christians call it? A veil of tears, a place of suffering. And the test is, how can I escape and not be hurt too badly? And obviously, since I can't control the wounds, the sword, the battles, all I really can control is the world that's within me. And if you want to know where this doctrine of salvation through faith, through the inner man, comes from in Christianity, it really comes from this totally non-Jewish perception, which begins in a statement, a categorical statement, about suffering being of the essence of life, but says as the principle of hope, he who has his spirit under control, who doesn't want too much, who knows that he is his own person and his own master, that person can really not be broken, not be hurt too much. Now, how do I show that I can get control of myself? How do I prove my mettle, my courage? The oldest of the heroic tales of the Greeks knew only of battle and of physical courage. That's the great theme of the Iliad. But as the Greeks developed, they quickly recognized that physical courage was only a beginning. They never gave up on this idea. The Greeks, more than any other civilization we've ever had, constantly put men into dramatic forms of competition against each other. We call the Olympian Games games, by which we think of, you know, happy moments when children are out playing softball in Little League. But these games were matters of life and death. And a hero who went to the games and didn't win was disgraced and often didn't have the courage to come back to his home community. These were matters of terrible contest between men. The whole basis of Greek civilization was and retained a kind of emphasis on physical prowess, on the muscular beauty of the male body, on physical force, which is its inheritance from the Iliad, its inheritance from this old concept of virtue being courage. But as the centuries came along, the Greeks recognized more and more that courage itself is only a beginning. Now, they never gave up on physical strength as an element of virtue. They began to recognize that the true way in which one showed the courage was in terms of one's mental fiber, the courage of one's mind, more than the courage of one's fists. And so we get in Greek thought an emphasis on the mind, the likes of which we have not had in any other major cultural tradition. The mind becomes the true reality. In Stoic thought, the mind becomes the only real thing, the only thing which is crucially important. And the Greeks had the feeling, in all of their philosophic systems, that the real test was whether I can think the true thoughts. Because if I can think that what I need to know truth, then I will do what I need to do, there can be no question about it, and my life will have a proper form of regulation. Let me try and explain that. When the Greeks asked the question, why do men act foolishly? The answer was not because men are fools, but all men want the same thing. All men want to act in such a way that it's a benefit to them, that it brings them happiness, that it brings achievement. What's the problem then? The problem is that most men don't know in what reason, truth, common sense really consists. We are, most of us, creatures of conventional responses. If you want to test it, ask yourself how many words you've picked up from the pop culture in the last few years that you never used up till now, and whether you use them in any kind of significant way or are simply, you know, parroting a set of ideas about, you know, doing one's own thing, being genuine, etc., because they happen to be current at the moment. Think of the confusion that you have, that I have, when we face political decisions, personal decisions as to what we should do and what we should not do, as far as family, as far as basic human relationships, loyalty, sex, truth, honor, etc., etc., etc. We all want to do what is best for us. We simply don't know that which is best. Now, the Greeks assumed that one could know the truth. One could be informed, truly informed. And so the best of their philosophy takes the form of critical dialogue between a teacher, a Socrates, and a series of disciples. And the disciples tend to mouth the conventional attitudes about beauty or truth or love. And the teacher essentially pins them logically to the wall by pointing out inconsistencies in what they're saying. Now, often this kind of criticism is simply destructive. But its real purpose was not to be destructive, simply critical, cynical, nihilistic. Its purpose was to clear the mind of convention, of all the conventional attitudes about the good or the just or the proper, and to so that the mind can come to grips with that which is truly true. To the Greeks, a man is what his mind is. I will be and I will do, according to Greek thought, what my mind suggests to me I ought to do. There are no such things as inhibitions or deep psychological restrictions which might prohibit me, my will, from acting on what my mind tells me to do. That they didn't know about. What my mind informs me is right, my will can carry out. That's a basic Greek kind of principle. Virtue then lies in knowing the truth, in knowing what is right, what is fit, and what is proper. And there is only ultimately one definition of what is right, and what is fit, and what is proper. And that's what I've somehow got to grasp, and got to get to. Now, how do I do it? I am a creature of instinct, of passion, of compulsion. There are all kinds of pressures on me, which the Greeks recognize, which are not rational. And the Greeks said these pressures, these instincts, these compulsions, these passions derive from the flesh, from the physical. Sex is physical, they said. Appetites are physical. Fears are kinds of physical reactions to things. The mind is disciplined and without passion. And they created a radical dichotomy, a radical division between the flesh and the spirit, between the body and the mind. The flesh and the spirit, the flesh and the body trip us up. They cause us to do all kinds of things which we ought not do if we're in our right mind. They're the source of the appetites. They're the source of the instincts. The Greeks had a horror of what we call commitment, you know, giving yourself over to something without thinking about it. The great test is to think about it, to be totally disciplined, cold, dispassionate, carefully reasoning about what we do. And so Greek ethic tends to be the test of moderation, going only so far, judging critically and carefully every act, tuning oneself with the mind. They love to use the image of a violin. If you take the violin and you turn the knob, which puts tension on the violin string too far, and you rub the bow over it, the note is screechy and high. If you loosen that knob too much, it's a weak note and too low for its pitch. You've got to tune the violin exactly. And that fine tuning, that precise tuning of what we do, can be accomplished only when the mind is in control of the body. Only when we are disciplined rather than passionate. Somebody once wrote a book about the Jews as the passionate people. To the Greeks, this would be the greatest defamation one could heap upon a people, that they are passionate. Because the whole virtue of life was to be in control. never to lose one's cool, never to lose one's self-possession, to know what is true and what must be done, and to do it. Now, this division of the flesh, the physical, the mortal, the body, and the soul, the spirit, is obviously one which will remain basic in all of Western thought, basic to Christianity, heavy impact on Judaism in the Middle Ages, because essentially it says there is something which is of the earth, which is animal, instinctive, mortal, perishable, the flesh will die, and there's something which is immortal, of the divine reason, capable of thinking truth, capable of being divine in the sense of knowing, the spirit, the soul. When we die, the mortal, the physical disappears. The soul, if it has been inspired, enlightened, remains. They like to think of philosophy as a preparation for death. How was philosophy a preparation for death? Because it taught us to be careless, in the literal sense of it, to care less about the physical, to care less about the instinct, to care less about our appetites, to be more in control of them. To the Greek, the whole world in its basic form, the basic energy of the world was intellect, was reason. And they often defined God as thought thinking itself. We say E equals MC squared. We like to talk of energy as kind of a basic, electrical material force. To the Greek, this basic force was reason, intelligence. God was a supreme reason. That little bit of God in us was the higher capacity of the mind, the capacity to understand the beauty, the symmetry, the order of the divine reason. And it was this capacity which allowed us to know what was right, to comprehend truth, to gain control of ourselves. And so you have in this Greek world, in the first instance, an emphasis on man, an emphasis on man who must confront an implacable kind of fate, an emphasis on man's ability to confront that fate because he has something which is divine within him, the capacity for higher reason. The whole burden of life must be to prepare the mind to think carefully, truly, reasonably, and rationally. And that mind which thinks carefully, reasonably, and rationally is thinking divine thoughts, is preparing itself for its immortality, and cannot act foolishly, cannot do evil, cannot sin, because it is in control. That word that the Greeks used again and again, it's in control of itself, of one's self. Now, all of this tends to be very private, as you recognize. The concept of salvation and of responsibility is a very private one. The Greeks tend to say you're born into a certain place, don't fight against it, do what you can with it. Salvation, insofar as the Greeks thought of this term, and they thought a good bit about it, salvation comes in to the philosopher, to the man who can think the clearest and the best. Salvation tends to become an intellectual enterprise, and then also at the same time, a moral enterprise. And the state, the most appropriate state, is not that which is run as a democracy by the will of the people, or pragmatically by some kind of social engineering, but it's one which is run by the philosopher king, by those people who have so cleared their minds, so gained control of themselves, become so understanding of the basic order of life, nature, and man, that they can offer good, sober, solid kinds of directions. The philosopher, the man of wisdom, is exalted in a unique kind of way. And he is the man who must be looked up to. Alexander the Great may be the conqueror of the world, but to the Greeks he could conquer the world because he'd had Aristotle as his tutor. And Aristotle helped him to understand how to manage men and nations, how to govern himself. He didn't do a very good job of it, by the way, but this is what they understood the truth to be. Let me sum this up in this way. The most important of the dialogues of Plato is the Republic. And the Republic concludes with a myth. The myth is about a hero by the name of Er, E-R. Er is killed like Sarpedon on the field of battle. And his body is hauled off from the battlefield with all those of the other corpses of that particular engagement. And when they come 10 days later to build the great funeral pyre on which they're going to burn all of these bodies, they find that mysteriously Er is alive. His body has not decomposed. He awakens and begins to talk to them. And he says to them that he died. And he was taken by the gods up into the heavens to a great meadowland. And he felt himself between the heavens and the earth. And he saw two great holes in the heavens and two great holes in the earth. In one of the holes from the heaven, he saw a whole group of people who had died in the battle with him going up into the heavens. And right below this, in the hole that was in the earth, he saw another number of the corpses who had come up with him from the battle descending into the bowels of the earth. Now, the other set of opposite holes, he saw as those where a procession of people were descending from the heaven and ascending from the earth. And he went over to meet them. And they began to tell them their stories. Those who had been in heaven told him of 1,000 years of delight in the Elysian fields. And those who had been under the earth told him of all the tortures of the damned in hell. And they compared these notes. And they lived in this kind of meadowland, speaking with each other for 8 days. Those who had been in heaven told of great joy. Those who had been under the earth told of their punishments. And they told also there were some who were so severely condemned that they were not allowed to come back up into the meadowland. And then after 8 days, and all of these people who had died 1,000 years before and been through purgatory or been through their heaven were taken along to the edges of the earth, what it's called the spindle of necessity, the spine of the world exists. And there the fates spoke with them. And the fates said to them, look, you're about to be reborn. And here I have a great big vase in which there are all the biographies of all the people who you are going to be. I'm going to throw these out, and you can pick up the one that most suits your fancy, and you will be that person. We're going to pick lots to see how you pick. You can become a tyrant, you can become a peasant, you can become a merchant chief, you can become an adventurer. You pick what you will. That is determined. What is not determined is whether, having picked this particular biography, you will live by a life of virtue, of intellect, or a life of folly and of ignorance. Agate, the Greek word for intellectual virtue, is not determined. That's your freedom. And he watches as the various people pick out the destiny that they want to take. And then he watched as they were taken to the river of mindlessness, where they drank from the waters of forgetfulness, and they were immediately translated down to earth to be born into their new existence. Now, what you have is a very familiar concept of birth and rebirth. What you have is a closed universe. There will be as many men today as there were 1,000 years before. What you have is a sense of predetermination, of destiny. You are destined to be what you are now, and you can't change your destiny. What can I do? I can live as a peasant, I can live as a king, intelligently or foolishly. That is my freedom. And that's the amount of freedom that the Greek felt himself to have. He could be a philosopher, even though a peasant. He could be a fool, even though a king. Now, that's not a great deal of freedom. It's not a freedom which makes us think of social change. It's not the kind of freedom which makes us think of, you know, revolutionizing the social structure, of having great revolutions, and peaceful or military, which will bring about, you know, expect what we expect of our world. It's a kind of burdened existence, and Greek life was burdened. But the freedom is right here. What I know, what I feel, how I react, what I don't allow to hurt me, whether I'm thinking the good thought, the true thought, or whether I'm acting, thinking the false thought, the misguided thought, and being foolish. If you want to know, since we started with Odysseus, and I'll close with this and we can have some questions. Odysseus, the great wanderer who took 10 years to come home, was among those that Ur saw picking up his lot. Now, I'll give you two guesses of what kind of new world, new life Odysseus took for himself. He wanted a very little life. He wanted to be a homebody who'd live with his slippers and his pipe by a fire, never be called up to civic responsibility or to war. So if you want to know what you were in your previous existence, ask yourself, you know, what gives you greatest pleasure now, and how you would have missed that in some previous existence, and maybe you'll know what you were 1,000 years ago. Now, throw your questions at me. None? Yes, Matt.